So this practice is meant to equip us in different ways to deal with difficulties that a human being might encounter. And some of these strategies are on the fly, things that we can implement in the moment that may reduce the sense of burden on the heart. And we could think of them as kind of short-term things that we, when we remember, we can just do. And they may be very helpful. And that might mean using our attention in a certain way. It might mean contemplating some teaching. It might mean changing what we're doing in our speech or action. It might mean saying the kind of mantra that I was alluding to at the beginning of class, oh, I'm going to suffer, and coming to terms with that. And most of the time when people think of practice, they think of it in this way of having tools to deal with suffering as it arises. And that's an important dimension of practice. But what we're doing in a more fundamental way is changing the conditions by which suffering arises. And this is a kind of more gradual, long-term process. And it's not something that we can just pick up and say, I want to be rid of this suffering right now. This is something that is cultivated over time. And so what we're ultimately doing is changing the baseline, the place that feels like home. The place from which we live that feels like home changes over time. A lot of practice, you know, when we talk about practice in daily life, practice during the day, sometimes that means explicit techniques. So we follow the breath for a minute during the day. Or we reflect on a certain teaching for a moment. Or we're conscious of certain habitual reactions. But ultimately, we're going to come to rely on the inertia of the mindfulness and open-heartedness that we create in the past. That we're building a kind of momentum that can fuel us through the day so that our baseline level of clarity and open-heartedness changes. Ken MacLeod, who will come lead the group next week, is very clear that much of our reactivity, and not much, all of our reactivity in some ways is out of our hands. That the particular emotional reaction we have to living is out of our hands. It's not in our control. We can't decide to not have the feelings of anger any more than we can decide to not hear the fan. But the freedom comes in our a kind of mindfulness or compassion bell going off. And that's not something we exactly choose to have, right? It's a little bit like when we wake up from a distracted period in meditation. It's not like that's a conscious choice we make, right? We don't say like, wow, I'm totally daydreaming right now and maybe I'll get back to the breath, right? We kind of, at least at first, pop out. We pop out of being submerged in unconsciousness. And over time, the practice helps us pop out from reactivity too. And so Ken says, what dissolves confusion is the momentum and energy that we've built up through your practice. It is your path that dissolves confusion, not you. Now this, is a long-term project, and that's why we often talk about living a Dharma life. Which, if this is your first time meditating, may sound especially foreign. But what's being pointed to is that this is this practice, if we give it a chance, wants all of our life. It wants it all. It does not want to be kept in a box, to be our stress reduction period or our a technique that we use. And that's not to be dismissive in any way of its function to reduce stress or to help us with certain problems. But the nature of the Dharma is it wants, it will spread in your mind if you let it. And as it spreads in the mind, these habits of reactivity set off the Dharma alarm bells more often, more quickly. And so ultimately we're changing the texture of consciousness, the texture of how our life feels. It doesn't mean all our patterns of reactivity change, but the texture of the consciousness that we live in, dwell in, changes. And one of the ways it changes is that we dwell more and more in what's called the Brahma Viharas, the translated sometimes as divine abode, or kind of the word etymologically I've read is sort of a kind of dwelling. And the ordinary default of the human mind through all of our evolutionary programming, the normal default is towards craving and aversion and unconsciousness. It's really good not to take that personally. Not to actually be able to hear that in a way that's not personal. But this is the place to which the mind defaults. When we're not paying attention in a certain way, we're very often entangled in fantasies of pleasure and pain. And evolutionarily, it makes sense that we spend a lot of time planning our way out of difficulty and into pleasure. But the Buddha said that this is a kind of way of trying to plan ourselves out of the First Noble Truth, which is that there's some difficulty inevitable. And so through our practice, we're beginning to change this baseline place, this home to which we return. And over time, the place to which we return more and more could be called something like love. In a very specific kind of love. Now, in these teachings, the Buddha said something very powerful that has a different tone from a lot of the suttas, the recordings of the Buddha's sayings. And it's a theme that's picked up quite fully by later traditions in Buddhism. But in terms of the original, the earliest recorded teachings of the Buddha, this theme is not offered too frequently. But what he said was that the mind is naturally radiant and pure. And it's only when the visitors of craving, aversion, unconsciousness blow through that we become entangled and we think that the problem is with us. That our mind is the problem. This is not something to be taken on faith. And belief isn't really of much value with this anyway. But the question is, what happens to the mind? What qualities are expressed when we stop trying to manipulate experience? When we stop trying to do anything with our mind? What's left? This is something for each of us to explore. Naturally radiant and pure. And it's the what's called traditionally the defilements, greed, hatred, delusion, craving, aversion, unconsciousness, those broad categories of experience that come through and we identify with them and it shakes the mind and we think that shaking is who we are. And so from this perspective, we're not seeking to create what I'm calling love. We're not seeking to manufacture something that is foreign. And this is why the path of wisdom converges towards love. So Sharon Salzberg has done a lot of teaching around this. Says that there are four qualities that are traditionally acknowledged: compassion and sympathetic joy and equanimity and metta, or a loving friendliness or loving kindness. And she says there are four, but in some ways we could think about all of it flowing from metta. That the compassion and joy and equanimity flows from metta. I'll say a bit about this. It's maybe easiest to talk about metta by first talking about what it's not. So it's not sentimental love, and it's not passion. Sentimental love, sentimentality, niceness, Hallmark cards, that stuff. There's a patronizing quality to it, and there's just an artificiality of niceness, right? We are all at times kind of nice, right? Like, have a good day, you know, right? As we're wherever our mind is, right? That's nice. And it's not passionate love, although perhaps it can coexist in the context of family love and relationship, although it's often becomes blended with the passionate side of love, which has a possessiveness to it and a difficulty allowing the other person to be exactly who they are. Now, I remember with an old girlfriend that was a long relationship, and the process of letting go was really slow. Really slow. And in that process of letting go, there was still this kind of, there was still a hook. There was still a hook in me, and I couldn't fully allow her to be and to have her life and to be who she was. There was still some aspect of possessiveness. And I cared for her and wanted to see her well, but that was mixed up with a subtle sense of possession. And I remember when that finally released. And I really had let go. And it was so relieving to not care in that way anymore. And to be able to allow her to be exactly as she was, for our relationship to be exactly as it was, for our love to, and the memory of that to be what it was. and the relief that comes when we're the love is not born of clinging. And this is maybe some of what is pointed to by this word metta. Sometimes talked about as a kind of very non-specific, unobstructed form of caring and well-wishing. A metaphor that Sharon uses is like water being poured from one vessel to another. And there's a very spacious quality to this experience of metta. That it's really an antidote to the sense of fearful alienation that we often find ourselves in. You know, the default place to which the untrained mind returns feels quite alienated in a certain way. People don't always realize it, just how disconnected we can feel from ourselves, from others. But the experience of metta is one of connection and a deep sense of the poignancy of being human. That this longing for happiness that I alluded to during the practice period, that longing itself, there's something so blameless about it. Now, what we do to secure our happiness may be skillful and it may not, but the seed of longing for well-being, if we can connect with that, in ourselves, we begin to see that animating the faces and the eyes of others. We begin to see the way in which their movement and speech, action, announces that wish. And when we've experienced that with enough clarity in our own hearts, it becomes very natural to wish others well, too. And it's said that from this quality of metta, the other qualities flow. That in some ways, metta, when it meets suffering, then becomes compassion. And again, this comes out of our own deep encounter with what it's like to be human. The experience of compassion flows more naturally, more effortlessly, when we ourselves have ventured deeply into whatever burden we carry. And this is part of the connection between mindfulness and compassion, that it's the clear, equanimous experience of our own our own difficulties or times of dissatisfaction that enable us to see that in others clearly. And it's not a moral rule or obligation that we're to feel a certain way, but instead something like the way the heart shows up. Because the suffering that we see in the world is no longer so remote when we've experienced the full range of our heart and mind. And we don't even always have to have had a difficult experience that we're seeing to know the pain of it, to know that in a visceral way. And so we can come to share in some ways in pain without being disoriented by it. And there is joy. Mudita, sympathetic joy, which is specifically alluding to the way we could say that love meets the happiness of others. And when there's some sense of self-sufficiency and some sense of having enough ourselves, it becomes more natural to be unintimidated by the happiness of others. And the Dalai Lama says the capacity for sympathetic joy, for taking joy in the well-being of others, multiplies our chances of being happy by 6 billion. And yet we all know the experience of the other end of what I'm calling mudita, which is jealousy or envy, right? When the experience that the happiness of another actually threatens something about us, threatens our own sense of abundance or lack of. And one of my teachers has said that that the experience of jealousy is a kind of perfectly highlights the insanity of egoic life. The ego, real in a certain way, can tolerate no goodness outside itself. There's an inherently possessive force to self-identification, to what we could call a small self, gets called a lot. And to be confronted with the joy of another and be, wish that for them not to have that is the kind of folly of the contracted self. And it makes us incredibly vulnerable as we go around life, because we're being confronted a lot with things that other people have, with their successes, with their spiritual successes, with their whatever good fortune. And to be able to share open-heartedly in that is relieving. It's relieving. But it highlights where we ourselves feel like something is missing and where we ourselves are identified, where the roles and ideas we have about ourselves that we hold very to be very precious about who we are. Because we're not actually intimidated by joy that doesn't have relevance for our self-image. I know I'm kind of, I'm making a little bit of a Brahma Vihara laundry list, and each of these topics are worthy of their own talk and series, and they are available online. But I want to give some sense of the place to which the mind can begin to default more and more. And so there's equanimity too, which is often considered a kind of balancing factor. And that actually, it's said by one teacher, the only thing we can't get enough of is mindfulness. The only thing we can't max out on is mindfulness. But everything else can actually put us out of balance if it's not counterbalanced by something. And this is often said with compassion and equanimity. So Sharon writes, even in one day or one hour, we can experience so many extremes of pleasure and pain. The question is, how can a human heart, my heart or your heart, absorb the continual, unremitting contrast of this life without feeling shattered and thinking we cannot bear it? Battered by the changes, the heart-mind can become brittle, rigid. It can wither and shrink. The Buddha said that our hearts can wilt as a flower does when it's been out in the sun too long. And so the practice, teaching practice of equanimity points to both a relationship to our own sensory experience, one of not fighting with ourselves, with what's arising in the moment. But in this context, it also points to our limitations in controlling the first noble truth. That because we're so skilled and have developed such amazing minds and tools that we can actually find our ways out of suffering often by moving or doing a million things that we do all the time, and that's not a problem, but it's created the illusion that the First Noble Truth is kind of optional and that we can find our way out of it. That we can be free of all discomfort. And so this teaching points to the limitations of what we can do and the limitations of what one's actions, even if deeply compassionate and deeply effective, this can only do so much for another human being. And the freedom of their heart depends on their own efforts and initiative. And so it's not a dismissive coldness towards suffering, but it's an acknowledgement of what can and can't be done. and is said to be a deep, spacious, still, unperturbed balance. And in a certain way, we can think of metta as being that which compassion, joy, and equanimity grows from. But in another way, we could think of equanimity as being that which the others grow from. And in the Buddhist psychology, the deepest happiness is peace. And I've had this experience of feeling that even love can be slightly fatiguing. I was up at Spirit Rock and we did this exercise where people got in two rows, right? And you're facing one another. And each person walks in turn blindfolded down the row. And each person whispers something like very kind in their ear. And there were, 100 people at this thing. And so from 99 people, you're hearing something as nice and kind as they can muster, right? And some people, it was just sort of generic what they would say. And it was, just wishing you well. But sometimes people, picked up on something. And what they said was just, so right on somehow. And it was so sweet. And people are, crying and, there was one woman and I said oh, I think you're falling in love with the Dharma, and she just squealed with delight. All right, and so this is going on for an hour, right? And so much love, really. The non-possessive, spacious, open love. And as beautiful as that is, at some point the heart wants to fully rest. And for the heart to fully rest, we need to let go very deeply. And we can see that in some ways the deepest wish is for the heart to be completely at rest and unstimulated by the passing experience of the mind. And this is not a kind of deadness at all, or a detachment at all. From that stillness, the face of that stillness is love. But there's, it's like the idle point is complete rest. And so we're cultivating a different baseline. Different place to which we return and return. And it's a place of a quiet love.